السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، حبيب إله العالمين أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المنتجبين. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. إن عدة الشهور عند الله 12 شهرا في كتاب الله يوم خلق السماوات والأرض منها 4 حرم، ذلك الدين القيم، فلا تظلموا فيهن أنفسكم، وقاتلوا المشركين كافة كما يقاتلونكم كافة، واعلموا أن الله مع المتقين. صدق الله العلي العظيم، وصلوا على محمد وآل محمد. According to the Quran, in chapter number 9, verse 36, God tells us that the months of the year, as we know them, are numbered at 12. And from among those 12 months, there are 4 months which are categorized as hurum, meaning that they are sacred. What are those sacred months? Rajab, Sha'ban, Ramadan. Those are the 3 months which come after another, and Muharram. So those are the 4 months out of the 12 months, which are considered hurum, sacred. And the reason why they're considered sacred, for a few reasons. We know that the sacredness of these months was preserved even before the advent of Islam, which means that even the tribes, the people that would fight one another, they would cease fire, they would cease fighting during those 4 months. The Arabs were a very particular people. They knew when to fight and when to stop. So that there was a sort of sacredness in these months. And the sacredness was protected even after Islam. And it was emphasized even after Islam. And that's really what makes the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam so much greater, is that he was killed in a month that even before the days of Islam, people would preserve its sacredness, its sanctity. They would not fight. So these 4 months, Rajab, Sha'ban, Ramadan, and Muharram. When the Hijrah took place, the migration marked the beginning of the calendar. But during the time of the second Khalifa, the calendar was changed and Muharram became the first year. And it stayed in that fashion. There's no problem with that, when it begins and when it ends. As long as there are 12 months, and we know which of those 12 months, among them, which 4 are sacred, which are mentioned in the Quran. Now this verse is in Surah At-Tawbah. And as we know, Surah At-Tawbah begins with a verse. First of all, it begins without what? Every surah has that it doesn't have.
Bismillah.
And commentators have said this is due to a few reasons. Some have suggested that it was revealed, this chapter was revealed with the chapter before. And originally when it was revealed, it was all revealed as one chapter. Some have said that there is no Bismillah because when you begin with the name of God, when you pronounce the name of God, you are speaking of protection and amnesty. And because the first verses of this chapter does what to the non-believers? It removes what from them? The protection and the amnesty which was granted to them. Because it removes it, Thus, they say that there is no Bismillah, because this means that there is no more amnesty. There's no more security for the non-believers who fought against the Muslims. And most of chapter number 9 speaks about the fighting against the polytheists. Even this verse itself says to fight the polytheists. Now, this is revealed in a certain context. What I'm trying to say is, out of the 4 months, Rajab, Sha'ban, Ramadan, and then Muharram, we are now during the final days of Jamadi Thani, or Jamadi Al-Akhir, and we are beginning the month of Rajab in the next couple of days. And the month of Rajab is very special. First of all, it signifies the beginning of Al-Ashhur Al-Hurum. That's number one. And number two, it's very special because according to the hadith of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he says that Rajab is the month of Allah, and Sha'ban is my month, and Ramadan is the month of my people, my ummah. And there are many acts which are recommended during the month of Rajab, such as fasting. Some people choose to fast the entire month of Rajab, Sha'ban, and Ramadan, which is very rewarding in itself. There are many occasions which come up in Rajab, Sha'ban, and Ramadan, many joyous occasions. If you look at the month of Rajab, the 18th of Rajab is what? What is the 18th of Rajab? Let's test your knowledge. The birth of whom? Amir al-Mu'mineen, 18th of Rajab. The 27th of Rajab, did I say the 18th?
Yes.
13th. The 13th of Rajab, thank you. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. I was trying to be smart. The 27th of Rajab, Mab'ath, Mab'ath al-Nabi. So when the Prophet was proclaimed as a Prophet, when he was sent as a Prophet, Mab'ath, Ba'ath, to be sent as a Prophet. Sha'ban also has a few joyous occasions, such as the mid-Sha'ban, Nisf Sha'ban, the 15th, which is the birth of our 12th Imam, Al-Imam Al-Hujjah, Ajallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Al-Sharif. We have the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of Sha'ban. The 3rd is the birth of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The 4th is the birth of Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. And the 5th is the birth of Al-Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam. So Rajab, Sha'ban, Ramadan are favored in the eyes of Allah, and they also have very significant events which take place. The first of Rajab is the birth of Al-Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. And so it begins with a great blessing. Now, who was Al-Imam Muhammad al-Baqir? He is the 5th Imam from the Imams of Ahlul Bayt. He is the son of our 4th Imam, Al-Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn. He is the father of our 6th Imam, Al-Imam Ja'far bin Muhammad al-Sadiq alayhi salam. And he was the first out of the Imams to be given the name Baqir, and also his first name, Muhammad. The first to be named Muhammad after the Prophet. And this was something which came from the Prophet himself. The Prophet said that they will come from my lineage. They will come from my lineage, an Imam with my name. And this is the Imam which will reveal knowledge after it has been concealed. And so for this is where he gets his name, Al-Baqir. Al-Baqir means the one who digs up and retrieves and uncovers. And so this is why he was given the name. Because after a period where Ulum Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, the knowledge and the sciences which had been put forth by the Prophet and by Amir al-Mu'mineen, after such a long time, when they were veiled, when they were covered, when they were basically placed under the dirt, Now came time to re-reveal that knowledge and elucidate and explain what was sent forth. And the first person to establish that was the fifth Imam, and to continue in his sunnah was his son, the sixth Imam, Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. His mother, her name was Fatima. Her kunya was Abdullah. And she was the daughter of, it is said, she comes from the lineage of Al-Imam al-Hasan al-Mujtaba. And so he is the first Imam to come from both sides, from Imams. So from his father's side, of course, his grandfather, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and from his mother, from the side of Al-Imam al-Hasan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam. And naturally, the Imam inherited the akhlaq of his grandfather, Rasulullah. Not only the knowledge, but also the akhlaq of his grandfather. You know, Rasulullah was known for many things, not just his knowledge, not just his generosity, not just his mercy, but his character and his demeanor. And this is why he was described as having great khuluq, a great demeanor. وَإِنَّكَ لَعَلَىٰ خُلُقٍ عَظِيمٍ. And naturally, the Imams which came after, they inherited this khuluq, they inherited the akhlaq. One of the things that he was known for doing was he would sit outside of his home. And it was when he would sit outside of his home that he would spread the knowledge of his grandfather. You know, his own personal space became a space of propagation. It was not that he needed, you know, a grand masjid or a lecture hall or a university. He did it in his own capacity. He sat outside the door of his home and he preached. You know, when God gives us certain talents and certain abilities, sometimes we're able to perform that within a certain capacity, which is effective. You don't have to have a university, you don't have to be a university professor or an alim to disseminate knowledge. There is, of course, guidelines that you have to follow, and you have to make sure that you're saying the right thing, and it is reflective of what Islam truly is and what authentic teachings are. But what is meant here is that whatever you can do to your own capacity is rewarded, is looked upon with favor from Allah. There's a famous narration which says that there was a man who, during the life of Rasulullah, he had asked Rasulullah to distribute his dates on his behalf after his passing. So this man passed away, and he had a lot of dates that were to be distributed. He didn't do it during his lifetime, but he asked Rasulullah to do it after his life. So he passed away, and Rasulullah spent a day distributing the dates and the food among the people. And when he left, this is the Prophet, when he left, the Prophet saw a small piece of a date, which was on the floor, it was kicked with the dirt. And the Prophet looked at it, and he told his companions. He said that had he distributed this during his lifetime, would have been better and more rewarding than all of this being distributed after his lifetime. The point is that while you can, you should. While you have the power and the ability, you should. And this is why there are other hadiths which encourage us to take care of or to take advantage of our youth before our old age, and to take advantage of our health before our sickness. So while we do have the blessings of Allah, we should do our best to make use of that and take advantage of that. And Al-Imam al-Baqir, with what very little he had, he took that as an opportunity to pave the way to disseminating the knowledge of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Now, Al-Imam al-Baqir, it is said that he was born on the 1st of Rajab in the year 57 after Hijrah. And if he was born in the year 57 after Hijrah, that would mean that he was born and he was old enough to see his grandfather Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Because if he was born in 57, that would mean that when Ashura took place, he was around 4 or 5 years old during the year 61. And in fact, some narrations have it that he was there on the day. And if you're 4 or 5 years old, you are old enough to see and witness and understand some things. So he was among those that were there on that day. One of the companions, which had a close relationship with the fifth Imam, was an old companion who had lost his sight. Who is this companion? He was a companion of the Prophet, Jabir ibn Abdullah al-Ansari. Jabir ibn Abdullah al-Ansari, we know, is a righteous companion. His father had passed away alongside the Prophet in one of the battles. And Jabir had to take care of his siblings. He had many sisters that he had to take care of. And he lived a very long and blessed life. And he lived long enough to see the fifth Imam. And the Prophet told him that one day you will see one of my grandsons who has the same name of me. And he is very knowledgeable and he will be the Imam of his time. And so Jabir, at that very, very old age, very blessed and old age, he comes across the Imam as a young man. He sees him as a young man or as a boy. And Jabir, of course, spending such a long time with the Prophet, had recognized the akhlaq of the Prophet. He had recognized his demeanor. He had recognized his presence. And when he saw this young man, or when he saw this boy who happened to be the Imam, he came into contact with him one day and he asked him a few questions. And just by the way that this boy replied, he understood that this was the one that Rasulullah was speaking to him about, just by the answers which he provided. Which meant that the Imam was very special from a young age. And the question here is, well, what determines who is designated as an imam? Is it strength, physical strength? Is it being the oldest? Is it being the most handsome, or the most generous, or the most trustworthy? Or is it something different? Is it character and nobility? And the traits which make a person worthy of imama. Now some assume that the oldest son after the imam would always be the next imam. And this is why there was confusion for some people. After the passing away of the sixth imam, the seventh imam, al-imam Musa al-Kadhim, was not the oldest son of the sixth imam. The sixth imam had older sons. One of his older sons was Abdullah. And this is why when we read the name of the sixth imam, we refer to him as Abu Abdullah. The father, because his oldest son was Abdullah, who passed away after him within a few days. Nevertheless, people went to Abdullah as the imam after the sixth imam. And he had a following. But this following died out. So it wasn't age, nor was it good looks, nor was it handsomeness. No, it was something else which Allah endowed into that young man, which made him worthy of the imamah. Now, he came in contact with Jabir, and it's interesting because Hadith al-Kisa, which we are familiar with, is narrated how? Who is the narrator? Fatima. Fatima is the narrator. But who narrates from Fatima? Jabir. And who narrates from Jabir? The fifth Imam, al-Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. So it's interesting. Al-Imam Muhammad al-Baqir narrates from Jabir, who narrates from Fatima, because Jabir himself, because Al-Imam al-Baqir himself did not live, was not born during the time of Fatima alayhi salam. Nevertheless, we know that Al-Imam al-Baqir inherited the akhlaq of his grandfather. And we know that, you know, Rasulullah and even the Imams which came after, Al-Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen, Al-Imam al-Hasan, Al-Imam al-Husayn, Al-Imam Zayn al-Abidin, all of them, in one way or another, experienced oppression from people. They experienced abuse. they experienced insults. You know, one day the sixth imam, a companion comes to him, and someone had just insulted the sixth imam. And so this companion comes to the sixth imam, and he's surprised that the imam did not reply or did not say anything to him. So the imam tells him, listen, God himself is not free of insults. People are insulting God. So do you expect them not to insult us? He's the creator and they still insult him. We're only the creation. You expect them not to insult us? So, you know, insult is something which is normal. If God is insulted, sometimes we get very, very, we get very offended when someone insults us. And we don't realize that people who are bigger than us have been insulted. People who are greater than us have been insulted. And you know, in parts of the world where sometimes people lose it and they get angry, and this is truly a sign of craziness. The other day they had on the news, a man was, a shopkeeper, was killed for insulting Islam. Why do you need to kill this person for insulting Islam? What is his insult going to affect Islam? Is it going to affect Islam? Is Islam going to be less true or less legitimate because a shopkeeper decided to insult, or a crazy taxi driver? In some countries you go, and if you speak long enough to the taxi driver, you'll understand what their real intentions are. They begin to insult everything which is holy, everything which is sacred. They even insult God and they insult the Quran. Does this mean that the Quran is any less legitimate than it is? Absolutely not. If a person decides to burn the Quran, publicly burn the Quran, does that make the Quran any less legitimate? Does it reveal anything bad about the Quran, or does it reveal something bad about that person? So the imams understood this. They understood that there was insult, and that even God was not free of insults. That's why, because they understood that, they always responded in a certain way. A man comes to an Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, and his name was al-Baqir, which means what? Al-Baqir, meaning the one who reveals. And the word al-Baqir has different meanings. One meaning is to cut through something. One meaning is to dig up something and reveal it. And he was given this name. Why? Because he revealed the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. A man comes to him, a non-Muslim man, he comes to al-Imam al-Baqir. And he knows his nickname is Al-Baqir. And he says, are you the one they call Al-Baqarah? Which means cow. He's trying to insult the Imam. He says, no, I'm Al-Baqir. He says, are you the son of the cook? His mother, the mother of Al-Imam Al-Baqir, she used to cook and provide food for people. He says, yes, my mother was a cook. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with being a cook. He says, are you the son of the such and such woman with a bad tongue? He kept trying to insult him by insulting his mother. He said, if what you say is true, that my mother is a foul-mouthed woman, if what you say is true, then may Allah forgive her. And if what you say is wrong, then may Allah forgive you. Very simple. He didn't need to say the same about his mother, about his father, about his sister, or anything like that. He simply said that if it is real, then I can't do anything about it. If my mom was evil, I can't do anything about it. May Allah forgive her. And if you're wrong, may Allah forgive you. Very, very simple. He didn't have to philosophize with him or anything. Why? Because he understood that insult is not going to reveal anything about the person who is being insulted. It only reveals something about that person who is insulting. Themselves are insulting. And so it is said, according to the narration, this non-Muslim person, when they witnessed the akhlaq of al-Imam al-Baqir, they accepted Islam. They entered into the fold of Islam. Now, of course the Imam came from a very noble lineage. And with that he had a noble family. One of the people who stood out during that time was his brother. He had many brothers. He had a few brothers. One of his brothers was the one who stood out. Was whom? Zayd. Zayd ibn Ali ibn al-Husayn. And Zayd was a martyr. Zayd was a shaheed. Because Zayd was one of the men who stood up against Banu Umayyah at that time. After what they had done in Karbala, and after what happened after that, because it didn't stop at Karbala, it continued after Karbala. You know, with what happened with the army of of Yazid ibn Muawiyah, what they did after Karbala was that they went where? They went to Medina. And they desecrated the masjid of the Prophet. And they even took feces and they threw it on the grave of the Prophet. And they began beating people and killing people inside the masjid of the Prophet. Reports tell us that they raped women inside of the Prophet. And after they finished with Medina, where did they go? They went to Mecca. What did they do in Mecca? Mecca at that time was controlled by Abdullah ibn Zubayr. They bombed the Kaaba with catapults from outside. They destroyed the Kaaba. As the Kaaba was being destroyed, Yazid died. The news came that he died. But it didn't stop there. The abuse did not stop there. And so, if you read the history of what took place after with Imam Hussein, during the rebellion, At-Tawabun, the penitents, the revolt of Al-Mukhtar ibn Abi Ubaidah al-Thaqafi, after him the series of revolts which took place. Among those revolts was the revolt of Zayd ibn Ali ibn al-Husayn. And he was killed as a martyr. And this was the brother of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, and Zayd also had a following. There were people at that time who would follow anyone who had a sword. Anyone who rose, and especially if that person was from the family of the Prophet, and if that person was rising, seeking to avenge what happened, all the oppression that happened to the Ahlul Bayt, this is exactly how the Abbasi Khalifas gained power. When they gained power, it was on a Friday, and it was on what day of the year? It was on the day of Ashura, and they were all wearing black. And they came out with black flags. People thought that they were coming out in support of Imam Hussein, which they claimed they initially were. Something happened after that, that they became more brutal to the Imams than the Umayyads were. If you read the history of the Abbasis, they were more brutal to the Imams of Ahlul Bayt than the Umayyads were. Now, that continued. Zayd lost his life. The Imam had other family members who were righteous. The confrontation, however, did not stop. The confrontation of the Imam with the Umayyad Khalifas did not stop. And during the time of Al-Imam Al-Baqir, alayhi salam, the Khalifa who was at the time who was most prominent was Hisham ibn al-Hakam. The difference, one difference, between the Umayyad Khalifas and the Abbasi Khalifas, the Umayyad Khalifas, their center was where? Their center, Sham, Damascus. The Umayyad Khalifas, their center was Damascus. They didn't move around so much. They didn't care to move around so much. They liked Damascus. Damascus was beautiful. Damascus had good food, good people. The people of Damascus at that time were not so familiar with the laws of Islam. Islam was very new to them at that time. And it had been under the control of Muawiyah for he was Khalifa for 20 years, and before that he was governor for many years. So you can imagine what the people thought and what sort of Islam was being practiced there at that time, right? What sort of deviation existed initially when the Umayyads ruled there. And so they stayed in Damascus. They were able to do whatever they wanted to do in Damascus, even though they had control over different parts. The Abbasis were different. The Abbasis first established Baghdad as their caliphate. They moved to Samarra, they moved to Khorasan, they moved back to Baghdad, and they eventually stayed in Baghdad. So they were, and when the Abbasis would move around, they would take the Imams with them wherever they were. And that's why we have Imams which are buried in Baghdad. That's why we have Imams which are buried in Samarra. That's why we have an Imam which is buried in Khorasan, in Mashhad. Because they would take the Imam with them. The Umayyads were a bit different. The Umayyads kept their distance, but they still wanted to keep an eye on the Imam. So that the Khalifa at that time was Hisham ibn al-Hakam. The Khalifa would sometimes come to Mecca to perform the Hajj. So he comes to Mecca to perform the Hajj, and he sees Al-Imam al-Baqir and Al-Imam al-Sadiq. عليهما السلام. He sees them both. Of course, at that time, the prominent imam at that time was the fifth imam, al-imam al-Baqir. He was the imam of the time. He sees that the imam is delivering a sermon on the merits of the family of the Prophet, and there are people gathered around him. Now, when they would hear the merits of the family of the Prophet, the Umayyads, it would make their blood boil, because who were their adversaries? Who were their enemies? The family of the Prophet. If they were to hear the name Ali, they would cringe, because they knew what Ali did to their ancestors. They knew well what he did. So, what happened? Hisham summons them. He summons al-Imam al-Baqir, according to the narration. He tells him to come to Damascus. He's brought to Damascus. And he sits next to the Khalifa. At that time, the Khalifa begins to insult him. And he tells the people that after I'm done insulting him, you may have your turn individually, each one of you come to insult him. So he did that. He insulted him and he had each person insult him after. Of course, the Imam kept his cool. And, you know, the Imams had this personality that even if you despise them, if you stayed long enough with them, you were attracted to them. So he put him in the jail. He found that even in jail, people were attracted to him. So he said, you know what? I got to get rid of him. So he leaves him. And he tells him to go back to Medina. Now, I'll end with one incident which takes place. As the Imam is leaving, now, Damascus, Ash-Sham at that time had a heavy Christian presence. And until today has a Christian presence. As the Imam is passing, he sees that there's a monastery. And right outside of this monastery, there's a monk which comes there at a certain time of the week. And he preaches to the people and people gather around him. And people are, you know, amazed at what this monk knows, the knowledge that he possesses and all of that. So the Imam sees him. The monk sees the Imam. He's attracted to him. He understands that this is a man of, you know, importance. So he goes to the Imam and he says to him, are you here to ask questions? The Imam says, no, I'm not here to ask questions. I mean, what would this monk know that the Imam does not know that the Imam would have to ask him? The monk was surprised because everyone comes to ask questions and be dazzled by the answers. He said, no, I'm not here to ask any questions. He says, okay, then let me ask you questions. He says, the Imam says, okay, shoot for it. He says, who are you? Which nation do you belong to? He says, I belong to the mercified people. The mercified people. What does that mean? The people, the ummah of the Prophet are the mercified people because their Prophet is a Prophet of mercy. And mercy was distinct to the Prophet. He was the only one which was known as the Prophet of mercy. No one before him is known as a Prophet of mercy. The word rahmatan lil alameen is given to the Prophet Muhammad. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. He says, I belong to the mercified people. He says, then let me ask you a few questions. He says that you claim that in heaven you eat and you drink and you consume, but no waste comes out of you. Nothing is excreted. There's no waste. He says, how could that happen? Logically, how could that happen? The Imam tells him, simple. In the same way that a baby in the womb of its mother consumes but does not give off waste. I mean, we have a live example in this world. How could it not be in the next world? He tells him, the monk, he asks him another question. He says, what hour, he tries to ask a riddle. He says, what hour of the day is not considered from the day, nor is it considered from the night? Or it can be considered both from the day and the night. There's an hour of the day. The Imam tells him what? Between when? What's the hour? Between Fajr and sunrise. Between Fajr and sunrise. He says at that time, it's not necessarily night because it's the beginning of the day, right? It's when people get up and they go to work. And It's not considered part of the night either because it's considered the beginning of a new day. So not considered night, nor is it considered day because it's still dark. And the Imam says something important. He says, it is in that way, it is in that time period, that those who are ill can receive their healing. And you know, I read about a study. It says that the purest oxygen that you can breathe is in that time of day. That's the purest oxygen that you can breathe. Most of us are snoring at that time. But it's the healthiest time for you to be awake. He asked him one more question. No, not in LA. In LA there's no time to breathe, which is good. He asked him one more question. He says, there are two brothers. Both of them are born on the same day. And when they die, one of them is 100 years older than the other one. How can this be? Uzair and his brother. And Uzair is mentioned in the Quran not by name. أَوَكَالَّذِي مَرَّ عَلَى قَرْيَةٍ وَهِيَ خَاوِيَةٌ عَلَى عُرُوشِهَا. And remember the one who passed by the village and he saw that everything had been collapsed, the roof had been collapsed. And so he asked, how could God give life to this village, this town, after it has been abandoned, after it has been dead? So what did Allah do to prove the point? فَأَمَاتَهُ اللَّهِ مِئَةَ عَامٍ. God made him dead for 100 years. And then he woke up. And when he woke up, God asked him, how long have you been dead? He said, like the Ashab al-Kahf, he said, a day or a part of a day. A day or part of a day. And God told him, look at your food, it's untouched. And look at the donkey that is with you, it's still as strong as a donkey. Nothing has happened to it. But you've been dead for 100 years, and you were just woken. And so, he was born on the same day as his brother, but when they died, he was 100 years older, as if his life was paused for 100 years. And so when, you know, this Christian monk, he realizes that, you know, that these are the correct answers, he, according to the narration, he enters into the fold of Islam. See, the point is that the Imams never really had to impress anyone. They didn't have to go and sell Islam. They didn't have to beg people to join Islam. They were embodiments of Islam. When you're an embodiment of Islam, when you are confident, when you don't have insecurities, when you are strong, when you are representative of the message of Islam in your persona, in your character, then people will naturally want to say, I want to do what you're doing. And people will become curious. But if you go and you sell them, you know, some groups, they go and they sell Islam, right? And they operate in different countries. And, you know, I don't judge their intentions. Their intentions may be very good. But they go and they sell Islam. And they believe Islam is by the numbers. The amount of people that can join Islam and become Muslim, then, you know, you determine the success of Islam by the amount of people. It's not the quantity, it's the quality. And the greatest quality people are the ones who witness your good character, and then they want to also adopt your good character. And that's why the Imams, from all of them, from the Prophet all the way to the end, they never tried to sell Islam to anyone. They never tried to sell the message of Ahl Bayt to anyone. Even the sixth Imam, he says that, invite people to us without your tongue, meaning without your speech. Don't try to sell it to anyone. Be Islam, act Islam, and people will want to join you, and people will want to follow you. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to allow this month, the month of Rajab, and the month of Sha'ban and Ramadan, to be months full of blessings, inshaAllah. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to reward us with the intercession of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. اللهم اغفر للمؤمنين والمؤمنات والمسلمين والمسلمات الأحياء منهم والأموات تابع بيننا وبينهم بالخيرات إنك مجيب الدعوات إنك قاضي الحاجات إنك على كل شيء قدير برحمتك يا أرحم الراحمين وصلى الله وسلم على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين.